This is the Early AI Podcast, hosted by Seth Early and Chris Featherstone. Join us as we delve deep into the passions, expertise, and experiences of thought leaders and practitioners to talk about what's possible with artificial intelligence. The Early AI Podcast is sponsored by Early Information Science, your digital transformation journey with design and deployment of innovative technology solutions, as well as CMS Wire. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Early AI Podcast. I'm Seth Early, and I'm really excited to introduce our guest today to discuss how emerging technologies like retrieval augmented generation will significantly impact organizations by improving information access. We're also going to talk about risks around the hype, around the risk that hype large language models, and what that poses for an organization if you don't adequately manage and differentiate leveraging your proprietary data, your intellectual property. We're going to be talking about the balancing of the use of large language models with oversight for utilizing those proprietary data sources and knowledge sources. And then how utilizing metadata for context is crucial to personalized experiences and improving information access. And we'll talk about the evolving role of AI in repetitive task automation that will reshape career paths and managing autonomous agents. So our guest today has been working on digital transformation programs for many years and heads product management for search and generative AI technologies. He has been working with corporate clients in financial services, manufacturing, and the public sector in APAC. He has a PhD in geophysics and has experience in oil and gas exploration and multiple years of experience with IT project implementation. He brings a wealth of experience in enterprise search and product leadership at Squirro, his current company, and his technical expertise drives the understanding of technology at a very fundamental level. Moritz Mueller, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to speak with you about what we do at Squirro and how we leverage, especially lately, the retrieval augmented technology to deliver state-of-the-art enterprise search.
And we don't want to be a commercial about Squirro, but we'll talk about Squirro. So we'll talk about concepts. And then, yes, we do want to know about Squirro because Squirro seems to be a really amazing technology. So I'm very impressed by that. But I just want to let people know we're not doing a commercial here. It's really about the knowledge and the fundamentals. But first, I'd like to start with what are the typical fallacies, the typical misunderstandings and myths that are out there that you run into on a day-to-day basis with executives, with colleagues, with customers, and so on?
That's a very good question. So the standard question that I get when we talk about Gen AI, combining LLMs with retrieval augmented generation then, is how do I train the model on my data? That's probably the first question that we got when ChatGPT came up last year. It's a question that we still get. And I understand that people ask that question, but I do not think it really reflects the challenges of using Gen AI and especially the retrieval augmented generation technology for your enterprise and organization. The challenge is much, much more on how can you combine the search and your own data with the respective capability, Gen AI capabilities of a large language model. Mm-hmm. And that's one of them. The other one of them, I think people often misunderstand the limitations of LLMs. So for instance, a lot of people always talk about, is my data secure? They're very worried, is my data going out to an API? Someone is doing something with my data. If you look at this, and specifically if you look at the example of ChatGPT, security-wise, I really think this is 100% safe. There's absolutely no question about this. We are so used to using the online resources of Microsoft, like Office 365, SharePoint Online, the ChatGPT models that we use in the private cloud is exactly on the same kind of systems. So there is absolutely no risk. The bigger challenge is, do you actually have a large language model available? And not only ChatGPT, but potentially something else to use that in your environment. That is the much bigger challenge.
Right, right. And so just for folks who may be less familiar with the terminology, when you say training the LLM, define the different ways of training and then just talk about retrieval augmented generation for a moment. Like how's that paradigm different than simply asking a question of an LLM. So first question is training. What does training mean? And what are the different ways of thinking about training? Because some people think that means you have to train the LLM itself, right? Whereas others, you think about tuning, and tuning is based on the data. So it's a similar concept, but it's very confusing. So can you clarify that for folks?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I start often with that. So for me, the whole talk about training comes from our historic experience. Whenever we talked about machine learning models or NLP models, natural language processing models, these models typically needed to be trained, or they were trained for your specific data. So for doing data classification, or for doing the task that they were supposed to be doing with your data. And for that, you trained the model, specifically also a chatbot, for instance, a machine learning model for a chatbot that was used. You trained the model to give good answers for that specific use case. With the emergence of large language models, and I don't want to dive into the details of how complicated it is to actually train a large language model, as I think the ChatGPT, you can break it down, the training of ChatGPT, for instance, in 5 different stages, but it's super complex. And there's so much data being used for the training, then the limited amount of training that you would do on your data would not fundamentally change the output of the LLM. Mm. So that's why when we talk about training in the past, very valid question, the moment we look at these pure dimensions of these large language models, the whole conversation actually shifted on how can we tune it, as you said, how can we configure it so that it gives us the best results, specifically for the use case that we are addressing.
Mm.
And the way to do this is twofold. One is, as you mentioned, we can look at how can we make the whole retrieval piece better. How can we retrieve the information from an underlying search system, for instance, to provide the right contextual information? That's one challenge. And the other challenge is, and you probably heard about this as well, is the whole prompting challenge. How can we make sure that we configure the prompting in such a way? And so we basically, when we talk about prompting, it is all about giving the right instructions to the large language model to tell the model what is it that we want to achieve.
Yes, that's very interesting. And you know, our next webinar actually is on the alignment of prompt engineering and knowledge engineering. So we're going to be covering that coming up soon. And I'd love to pick your brain more on that, whether we do it today or we do it a little bit later. But you know, I know it gets very complicated, but can you give a high level understanding or overview of those 5 stages of training that you mentioned? Because I have done some research and reading about large language models and the feedback mechanisms and just how unbelievably complex and sophisticated it is. I mean, it really is amazing. The just the self-referential continual feedback, you know, adjusting weights, adjusting the model as it's processing is just absolutely phenomenal. But do you want to just give a high level understanding of what those elements are? It's okay if we dive a little bit into the weeds. People who don't want to hear that can just fast forward.
That's fair, but I also need to be very honest with you. So I myself am not an expert of training LLM models. So that's, I think, cool. I can break it down, give you a high level understanding.
Perfect.
But for all the details, you really need to speak to an expert. It wouldn't be fair if I were speaking for that. So the way, if you look at ChatGPT, the way it works, the different stages, and again, 5 is not necessarily the final number, but you have different stages on how you train the model. You train an initial model where you throw in a lot of content, and you train a so-called base model. In the first version. And that can be maybe on a high level, just that the amount is much, much larger compared with the original training of machine learning models. So you train the model on all the text that you can get hold of. You need a lot of GPU power to do this. Someone told me that when I think Facebook trained their first proper LLM, they spend $60 million or so just on buying the GPU units to train that initial model. So it's a crazy investment that tells you already it's utterly impossible for an organization to just do it. So that's the first step. In the second step, the first step is, I think they call it pre-training. Then you do a so-called supervised fine-tuning, where you try to make sure that the general understanding is there. So you use certain prompts to teach the model certain outcomes. And that gets then refined more in the terms of a rewarding model, so that you basically tell the model, you ask them some questions, and it's a manual process, but you can also use some technologies to do this, where you ask some questions, and there's the feedback learning where you say this was right or this was not right. And the more of this training you can do, the better, of course, it gets. And that is also the stage where you later on can do the fine-tuning. You basically have a reward model to make sure, as the last layer on top of your trained LLM, you do more enforcement learning for specific use cases or kind of questions. So that is the additional layer that you can set on top of this. But overall, this whole process is super complex.
Yes.
And again, not me not being an LLM expert, but what I heard from ChatGPT, I think they were also the surprise themselves that their ChatGPT model worked so well. And it took them quite a while to understand which of these steps and how the combination of the steps actually led to being so successful and giving so good results.
Yeah, no, that's a great overview. And one of the things people forget is that there is a lot of manual training. There's a lot of human in the loop feedback. There are a lot of people making judgments about these armies and armies of people who are doing that. And then when they start red teaming to try to break the model or get it to do something bad, then that's even more human in the loop. So that's so interesting about training. Now, when you think about fine tuning, and this is where, you know, we talk about training, there's a lot of different ways to think about training, but I think more about fine tuning. And fine tuning is really how you're going to access your data with the LLM, and that comes into retrieval augmented generation. Do you want to just give a quick definition of RAG, and then what has to be done to the data to make it readily available for the LLM using RAG?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So if you look at LLMs as such, it is very impressive. If you go to ChatGPT, I think we've all tried it ourselves, and we asked the ChatGPT a generic question or general question. I even used it myself for instance, write some small routines in Python or get inspiration again because my Python days, they're passed by a few years, but I'm still trying from time to time. And it's impressive what the model can do. The moment it becomes specific, however, it is very challenging to source the right information. And the moment we talk about enterprise RAG in that sense, the task of the Gen AI technology is to give an answer that is specific to your organization or specific to your use case. And the general knowledge that the model is trained on likely does not contain that piece of information that you're looking for or that is required to give you the answer. So in order to overcome this, when we talk about retrieval augmented generation, we pair a so-called information retrieval technology with the capabilities of Gen AI, large language model, to give us an answer on a limited amount of data. So what I mean with this is you can, with a large language model, provide a so-called prompt or context to it. You can basically ask the large language model, say, this is my question. I have a question, for instance, let's say you work with some organizations here, they have certain procurement guidelines. And the question is then, up to which sum can I directly give out, for instance, a contract or a purchase order to someone? And up to when do I need to do a tender or something? Now, this information is specific to the organization. If you just ask the LLM, it will not exactly know what you're asking for. But what you can do is you can provide within the so-called token limit. So this is this prompting context. You can provide up to, well, I think ChatGPT at the moment has 10 to 20 pages of text, roughly. That's the way to look at this. So you could provide 10 to 20 pages of text of context. You say, this is my 10 pages with my procurement guidelines. And you can ask the model, say, this was my question. These are my guidelines. Please answer the question based on the guidelines that I provide. And that is what the LLM is able to do. It is very good in doing this. It will then basically abstract the knowledge in these 10 pages and give you that specific answer from it. Now, if you just look at this as the capability of the LLM with Gen AI to give you an answer, and this is very powerful. Now, however, For now and in the near future, we have a limit of this token limit. So you need to make sure you can put the right information in these 10 to 20 pages of text that you pass in this context. Now, if you want to use the capability on top of, for instance, your knowledge base, let's say you have a lot of documents on a SharePoint or in any kind of other Google Drive system that you have in your organization, 10 to 20 pages is probably not enough, right? You are very limited in terms of that. The way to overcome this is by doing first a search. So that's why we use the information retrieval step. We first conduct a search with your question and try to find the relevant documents. And not only the documents, we actually try to find the relevant pages inside of your document that contain the likely answer to your question. And with this, we then put together basically the 10, 20 pages of context. We say we take the top 10 results of our search engine. We always take one page of text, and then we put that together at 10 to 20 pages of context, and we pass that to the large language model. And then the LLM is basically able to give us an answer based on all the relevant pages that we have found in all of your knowledge base. And wrapping this up, this is basically the combination of semantic search on one side, where you can search through millions of documents, finding the right pages, and then you pass them on to the LLM for the generation piece to summarize you a nice answer based on these relevant pages that you have added.
That's great. That's great. And when organizations, when I've spoken recently with some organizations who've tried this, right, and they've just pointed it to all of their policy documents, and I'm not sure what repositories they were, but they got an answer. It was about lunch, what the reimbursement policy was for lunch and what the limit was, and the LLM returned back $180,000. And it was also for Singapore, of all places. And then they tried it again, and it was no matter where they you know, how they tried to define the area, it still came back with $180,000. Now, clearly, something went wrong. And when you start thinking about the repository, the quality of the data, you know, why you would get an erroneous answer like that, can you troubleshoot that a little bit? Can you talk a little bit about what makes good retrieval? Right, when you start thinking about semantic search, parametric search, metadata search, retrieval in general, what makes good retrieval? And then what do you have to think about with the data and the content?
Yes, happy to answer that. Before I exactly give you an answer to that question, let me make a general statement. I personally believe that in order to make retrieval augmented generation successful and useful, the challenge that we will face in the next years, where you will see all big organizations in the world, they will use the technology. They will use it on top of their internal documents and knowledge base because it's simply so powerful and can save so much money, it's an absolute no-brainer.
Yeah.
But the challenge to do this is much more on making the information retrieval work well than
yes.
improving and tuning the LLM. And that is something I'm trying to explain to people. The LLM, if you really give it the right context in this 10 pages of text, and 10 pages of text for me is just a symbolic thing. For the bigger models, this can be more, right? But if you provide the right information to the LLM, they are really good in giving you an answer. So the accuracies there are well above 90% from what I've seen. Now, the challenge is, as you mentioned, in terms of reimbursement policy, if you just point the information retrieval to all of your documents, the challenge is how do you find the most relevant document with the answer? So ideally, you point it to a most recent document. What we see in a lot of organizations is they have each year a new iteration of the document, and each previous iteration is stored in their knowledge base. So you want to have a certain time weighting factor in your information retrieval. That's one of the things. And on top of this, we also use a lot of other metadata attributes that we, for instance, say everything that is older than 1 year gets a massive decay in the search functionality. Everything that is not labeled, and you can add those labels as a knowledge-based document or that is pre-approved by someone, is not a relevant or most relevant search document. And now imagine you work in a company that has been around for 50 years. There will be tons of documents talking about reimbursements and maybe different versions. People save their own documents. So the challenge is really, can you limit initially the amount of data that you search through to the knowledge base that is pre-approved? And because once you do this, you will make sure that you get a much better context that you pass to the LLM to actually give you an answer. And that
So
is
that's the
our way of making retrieval augmented generation successful in any kind of organization.
That's great. And you know, it's funny, it comes still comes back to the old problem. And this is where people are misunderstanding the whole class of technology. It comes back to the old problem of context and information hygiene and knowledge curation, right? Because you can't point it to crap and get something back that's going to be useful. And you can't just point it to everything because there's no context. So context is hugely important. And this is where, you know, you're familiar with my phrase that I coined years ago, there's no AI without IA. This is kind of the exemplar of that. Why don't you explain that concept in this context? Because you really did just explain it, but it's a good way to summarize it. But do you want to just provide your interpretation?
So a basic interpretation of this is you need to make sure in a big organization you have at least a minimum level of data hygiene and knowledge management. Let me put it maybe like this. And it starts with every folder, as stupid as it sounds, but every folder name that is called policy already or HR policy is relevant metadata information for a search engine that we use. Now, I'm not asking to go back to the old good old days where everything was in folders. It is much more the question, how can we make sure this metadata is stored on the respective document? And you will find big organizations nowadays, they have knowledge management departments even. What I've seen is I've seen organizations here in Singapore, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, they have a huge amount of people, 50 people working just on knowledge management. Now, I'm not saying you need this to be successful, but if you can make sure that the knowledge base, the main knowledge base of data is maintained in a certain way that you remove old information, you archive it, or you tag documents that are pre-approved, saying this is our guide, this get boosted in the search. Then with this basic data hygiene, as I would call it, you make sure that not only the search is better, but also if you use retrieval augmented generation, your chatbot basically that you give to your employees or to your users finds you the best answer that you can get.
Yeah, and so the whole idea of information architecture is structuring that knowledge and that content in a way that allows you to retrieve it. And when you think about what is so incredible about LLMs is they interpret the question in the query in a very sophisticated way. And then they interpret and process the result in a very sophisticated way to make it more conversational. And in between is that retrieval part, right? Is that using your knowledge base, your database, your content. And when you just try to use a large language model by itself to answer a question, what does it tend to do if it doesn't have the answer? It'll make it up, right? Unless you are very specific in your instructions to say only use the information from this data source. If you don't have that information, say, I don't know. And then turning the temperature down to zero so it doesn't get too creative. One is very creative, zero is not creative. And so, you know, we've seen this work very, very well. And it comes back to, again, thinking about content. You know, in the old days, people would say, well, make it like Google. Make it like Google. Just make it like Google. And I would say, if you spent as much time and money and resources on fine-tuning your content that organizations do who want to get good rankings in Google, it would be like Google, right? Because it is about that curation, it is about that architecture, it is about that terminology. So it comes back to some of the old things. This is not a magic book, but it is an amazing tool. It's an amazing tool. I mean, just like when you think about a chatbot and you have to, you know, interpret intents from utterances and utterances. I forgot my password. My username doesn't work. I'm locked out of my computer. My computer's mad at me. Right? I just and it, but it all comes down to the same intent: change password. Well, large language models do that on steroids, right? They take very sophisticated questions, and then they can expand those prompts, or they can reconcile those prompts. But then they ask a question of the data source, and using the parameters. This is why prompt engineering, I think, is so important, because prompt engineering has to contain elements of that architecture, right? You have to train people how to ask the right questions and use the right concepts, and then you're retrieving either you're doing, and we'll talk about this, you're retrieving from that data source using a semantic search or using some kind of parametric or metadata search or other signals, and then you're taking that result and you're making it more human understandable, more conversational, right? That's what the beauty of this is. That's what the power of this is. It's the in-between part that we still have to get right, but the beauty of this thing is you don't have to, formulate every response. What I did like about the early days of chatbots is we looked at use cases and the specific content you needed for those use cases. So when I have an example, and I just found it on my phone, where I tried to find out how to activate a credit card, right? And I lost the little sticker on the front. And I am going with their chatbot, and it's giving me pages and pages and pages of information. No matter how many ways I just asked the question, it would give me policies about this and policy. All I wanted was the phone number to call. Now, if somebody had created that use case, they could have made that content very specific. So this is where, again, we have to focus on those use cases. We have to focus on personas. We have to focus on the additional signals, right, that tell us what an individual wants. It's funny on I listened to Hard Fork. Have you ever listened to that podcast, Hard Fork? And they're talking about the fact that Bard came out and was being very woke and very politically correct, and it wasn't giving pictures of white people and all of this stuff, right? It tried to overcorrect to not be biased about, everything being a white person, right? A white male or whatever. And essentially, what they said was, what persona do you want Bard to answer the question in? Right? Was it Bard or no, it's Gemini. I'm sorry, it's Gemini. Gemini. What persona, what perspective do you want it to be? Right? Like, what is the user's perspective? What is the user's orientation or mindset or capable or preference? And that comes from additional signaling, additional metadata about the user. Do you want to talk a little bit about that whole idea and the idea of really doing personalization based on the user? Like, we all walk around with a metadata cloud around us, right? And that metadata cloud tells us everything, can tell the world what we want and who we are, and we change our roles. And so, we talk about high fidelity journey models that kind of represent that user intent in metadata terms. Do you want to talk about that and how that really leads to true personalization? How does that fit in with all of this?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the first part of personalization, and I think that is important to mention in the enterprise and organization context, is you have in any organizations, you have so-called ACLs, access control layers.
Yep.
That means that you're probably all familiar with this. You have on a SharePoint, Google Drive, or whatever, you have only access to certain folders. There's certain information. Let's say an HR department, they will have information about salaries or contracts that is not for everyone's eyes. Now, we need to make sure when we use retrieval augmented generation that we only provide an answer based on the documents that you are allowed to see. So, how do we do this? The way to do this is really we honor all the so-called entitlements that exists. That means we know who you are when you log in. So we know you are working in this department, you have access to those files. And then whenever we do the search for information, we apply these so-called ACLs and make sure you only get to see documents that you are entitled to see. That is, for me, one crucial part of personalization in the enterprise context. Now, adding to this, of course, you also want to have an answer that is more personalized. Now, a second layer of personalization can be introduced when we introduce so-called knowledge graphs or knowledge systems. So you can, in big organizations, have goes along with the whole knowledge management, as I mentioned, the taxonomy handling. You understand who is this person, who, what is his role. We have had an example where, for instance, in a bank, an ESG investor, a CIO, and a normal banker, they will have different kind of results that they get back depending on the profile that they are that they have. Someone searches for certain information, and then we use the profile information that we have, so we understand who is this person, which department is in, and we have a similar kind of tagging because of the knowledge graph. We have a similar kind of tagging of the data on as metadata on the data, and then we boost the results differently depending on in which role you're in. So that's one of the key things that we do. And that's one of the key aspects of personalization. And other pieces, and I believe in the future there is a lot of development in this, is that you start LLMs to ask return questions. Because, I mean, very much if you ask an expert about something, you ask him a question, he will probably ask you a question back.
Right.
To focus the content much more, exactly, in a way, in a conversation, to focus is much more on the specific domain that you are interested in.
Yep.
Let's say you want to buy a house. You ask someone, oh, I want to buy a house. Where should I buy it? Person will ask you, oh, what are your preferences? You look for a big or a small house? Are
Do
you
you need good
more
schools?
Interested, more
You have
central?
School-aged children, right?
There you go. There you go. That is the whole personalization aspect. And I believe we get that in by applying additional filters on the data. At the end of the day, these are just filters.
Yep.
It's a matter of questions of how we apply those filters.
Yep.
If you take it a look at this and you abstract the whole process, is you apply a filter during your search, such that your initial document set, so you combine a semantic search, which is a word vector, a vector based search, with a metadata filter, and combined they give you a weighting of the search results that hopefully, or in the ideal work we know it works, it gives you a better search ranking for the individual person. But that is how we achieve a better degree of personalization.
Right. And I call that their digital body language, right? What are all the signals that they're throwing off as you interact with the different tools and systems? They're all storing metadata about campaign responses and interests and level of technical proficiency and equipment that they own and all of that. Just like a salesperson or a good service person would ask those questions, right? I do think search is a conversation, especially the old days of metadata-based search, right? When you or faceted search, when you put in a query that's ambiguous. If you went to the Grainger site and you typed in tools, imagine if you walked up to a counter at a hardware store and you said tools, they'd say, "Okay, what kind of tools do you want?" Right? And that's what it does with the facets. It says, "What kind of tools do you want here? Power tools, NAND tools, etc." And we're doing the same thing when we're asking those additional clarifying questions, right? And that's a really important piece because I think chat-based applications are going to increasingly rely on that prompt engineering to be able to identify the metadata and the entities and the metadata that's going to make that answer more relevant, just as you're explaining. So this is great. It's exactly how I thought of this in the past. And this is shows you how knowledge graphs come into being or come into play, and how you can use a customer identity graph or an employee identity graph that includes, you know, things like what they're provisioned for, what they have rights to, and so on.
You can also maybe say, well, just one comment is, so what we are seeing at the moment in our daily work, we're combining we're building in a second layer of logic. So when you ask a question, we are on a first NLP model that tries to decide which information retrieval processing line basically the command should go down. So if you ask a text question that talks about procurement policies, it retrieves a document. When you ask for a stock price, we point you back to a structured database that draws you a graph so that you do not get text as an answer, but you actually get a graph as an answer and a visualization where you have the information in. So the future will definitely see that these retrieval augmented generation technologies will become more and more complex and connect many different systems inside of an organization.
That's great. So, you know, I do want to give you a chance. I said this isn't a commercial about Squirrel, but I do want to give you a chance to talk about Squirrel. because it is such an amazing tool, and we're partners with Squirrel and starting to leverage it and want to introduce it to our customers. So talk a little bit about, you know, kind of how you see Squirrel in the context of other environments and other platforms and other tools. What are the real differentiators that you guys have? I think one of them is that you're able to use, well, different language models. Is that correct? And then tell me some of the other ones. Give me some of the other. It's very, very flexible, powerful tool. And you have the ability to do all this configuration, especially of those intents and the signals and the different types of roles and so on. So talk a little bit more about Squirrel as search engine and as about and about the integration with LLMs.
Yeah, I'm so happy to do this. So if you look at us as a company, we have been around for quite a while now, over a decade, and we have really started off as a search company. So Squirrel originally was considered a search engine, the platform. In the meantime, we are in the Gartner Magic Quadrant for so-called Insights Engine. It's then also, again, an evolution of the terms. So Insights Engine is the magic term. What is in the term Insights Engine for me is that you use, at the end of the day, a lot of analytic technologies, and you bring them together. So because you have so much data in an organization that you want to make sure your employees, so the smart brains in your organization, they find as fast as possible the relevant information for them. That is what this is all about. Now, for us at Squirrel, as I said, we have been doing semantic search for quite a while now, so we really know how to do search. And if someone asks me, oh, everyone talks out there about using ChatGPT, about using LLMs, what is special about Squirrel? I think the key answer that, and it potentially needs a technical person to understand that, but the key answer is that all of the solution out there, that just say they use ChatGPT, they are very much limited by this token limit at the moment. So they can prepare 10, 20 pages of text, and they allow you to chat with these 10, 20 pages of text. Mm. The moment it comes to your knowledge base, where you have more than just one document with 20 pages of text, or even an annual report, we have ESG questions on annual reports where you have 100 pages of text. Mm. These tools will not help you because they need first to do the so-called information retrieval. Mm-hmm. And I think that puts us in quite a unique spot because we can nowadays ship out of the box a platform that does all the so-called tokenization and embedding generation that you need for vector models for the mm-hmm. semantic search. And we give you a native integration of any LLM that you want to use. And why is that so important? ChatGPT is there to stay. ChatGPT has a lot of advantages. The big advantage of ChatGPT is it will be probably for quite a while be one of the cheapest LLM solutions out there. That is something very, very clear. But there will be other LLMs. And when you run a retrieval augmented RAG framework, as we call it, you want to have a bit of flexibility. With Squirrel, you can switch out the LLM with any other LLM that's out there. So we are completely agnostic to the large language model that we use. We nowadays even run it on-premise. So we use, for instance, for Mistral, I think the model is called Mixtral, one small model that we can run fully on-premise. I mean, I'm not saying this comes for free. It comes with a significant amount of cost associated with it, but we can do it fully on-premise. So for the work that we do, for instance, as our big banking clients, and some of these clients that are heavily regulated, they really need us to look beyond ChatGPT because their compliance is still struggling with approving that for some of the sensitive information that they have. And I think really because we have this decade of knowledge of how to do the information retrieval, how to do the semantic search. Mm-hmm. That is the reason why we are in such a prime spot on when you want to do this on top of your own knowledge base. Mm-hmm. And maybe just as a last step there, if I talk to clients here, everyone talks about Microsoft Copilot. Microsoft Copilot is great, right? Great tool. Mm-hmm. But if you want nowadays to do retrieval augmented generation, so question answering on your SharePoint, for instance, Microsoft is not giving you an out-of-the-box product at the moment. They are not. They will tell you, here are the 20 building blocks you need to put this together, so go and try it yourself. Ah. And that is the key advantage of Squirrel. You mm-hmm. can just basically buy it off the shelf. You say, mm-hmm. I want to do question answering on all of my documents, mm-hmm. enterprise-grade security, entitlement yeah. handling out of the box, we are able to provide.
That's great. That's a huge advantage. Now, when you think about metadata, we did an experiment with a life sciences company where we built a knowledge architecture, we componentized the content, but we ingested it into an LLM, and we ingested it both without the knowledge architecture and with the knowledge architecture to compare. And we found that when we had those enriched embeddings in the LLM, we were able to get much, much better results from 53% accuracy without enrichment in the metadata to 83%. So when you think about Squirro and how Squirro is doing this, you are doing vector-based search, yes? So, and then you're ingesting that content with the additional signals of whatever metadata is on those documents.
Correct.
That's great. Go ahead.
But maybe just to look at this. So semantic search alone will only find you the relevant paragraph inside of a document.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you ask a question about how to change the battery in the car, and you have all the manuals for cars loaded. Then this semantic search will find you from all the manuals, likely the paragraphs that talk about how to change the battery in a car. Now, that alone, if you have a Ford and you want to get the result for Mercedes, it will not help you. So the way to improve this is combining, as you stated, the semantic search with the so-called metadata search. That means when we store a document, we tag it. We say, this document is related to this specific Ford model. Mm-hmm. This document is related to this specific car model, like a Mercedes, BMW, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we store that metadata on the respective items when we index them.
Okay.
Now, when you ask the question, you basically ask how to change the battery in my Mercedes. Then we use technologies that understand, oh, you want this car model. So I first run a filter, like a faceted search, with that respective metadata to filter down all the amount that you of data that you search in. And in a secondary step, you then run the semantic search to find the respective paragraphs in the fitting document. And that's how we combine the so-called metadata search with the semantic search to make sure you get the most relevant output after doing it.
That's interesting. But you could also say that the metadata with the document would be additional signals for the LLM, but you're doing it in a stepwise fashion. You're filtering first and then using the LLM. But could it conceivably be done the other way, where you're saying, I'm just going to ingest this and I'm going to use that those embeddings. I'm going to enrich those embeddings with additional metadata and then use that with a vector similarity search? I know that's a very technical question.
You can also do that, right? You could, of course, also do this. It's just, so if you look at vector search, it becomes, so we do this, we add to, for instance, typically when we index the individual paragraphs, we decide that we always want to index, if you look at a document index, you always add the document title as part of the embedding.
Right.
The same you can do with metadata. I'm just not convinced that it solves the problem, because if you, as I mentioned before, in RUG, the challenge is the so-called token limit that you have, the context. So if you find now a lot of embeddings that talk about these kind of things, you still need to limit it to these 10 pages of text.
Understood.
So if you get the right result with the semantic search approach, or by combining semantic search with a metadata approach, at the end of the day, it does not matter, as long as you can make sure you find the right paragraphs.
Understood. Totally, totally get it. And we are also thinking in the fact that you have to componentize content, you know, because when you bring it into an LLM, you kind of break it up into arbitrary, you know, frames, and you have overlap between those frames for context, but that doesn't always give you the context. You know, the example I use is, if you have an error code for a particular product, well, if you just said to a service tech, I have an error code of 92, right? Well, okay, what do you own? What modem? What's the configuration, et cetera? And that would have to be on that piece of content, right? That contextual metadata, right? So then in that case, yes, you could do it filtering it first, right? Doing a parametric search or retrieval, and then you could use the LLM. So I could see how both those ways would work. So we're almost out of time here, but I wanted to give a couple of questions to learn a little bit more about who you are. You are located in Singapore. And do you want to talk a little bit about how you got to what you're doing? And, you know, I know you worked in oil and gas exploration. I know you have a PhD. How did all that kind of impact what you're doing now?
That's a story.
Outlook? Yeah.
So, I mean, the main part is,
5 to 8 minutes.
Yeah, happy to speak about this. So I worked in oil and gas after my bachelor and master's, and I really enjoyed this. It's exciting. Oil and gas is technology-wise one of the most advanced fields that we have as humanity. It's really amazing. And if you look at it nowadays, a large part of our economy is still driven by it. So really, really amazing. But then I decided, look, I want to do a PhD. I went back to university. I appreciated this. I learned a lot about the techniques. And then I think it was a phase where the oil price was down. I decided I didn't want to go back into a cyclical business. So I started, and at the time in Zurich, I started to go into consulting work, and I ended up at an AI company. That's how it often goes.
I'm sorry, what company?
So I first worked for a consulting company in Switzerland, and then I switched at some point over to Squirrel,
Okay.
AI company. Again, very
Oh,
exciting for me.
yeah.
And when we had our first project in Singapore, I came here to lead this project because it was a lighthouse customer for us, a very big project. And then I committed at the very beginning of 2020, I committed myself to open up an office in Singapore. And I flew in 1 week before the COVID lockdown to Singapore. And that was a hell of a ride then for 1.5 years.
Wow.
But
And
I don't have any regrets. I really like the place. It is fantastic to see Singapore, and also how technology here is evolving. I think there's a lot of potential in this area.
I've never been to Singapore. I would love to visit, and
You're always welcome.
yes. And I've forgotten. Do you have a family out there?
No, I don't have a family here, but I'm pretty sure they would also enjoy it. Otherwise, everyone that comes and visits me only complains that it is basically warm every single day, but I really like it. I do miss the Swiss winters, I have to admit that, and a bit of snow once in a while, but you can get that during Christmas break.
In New England, we're to the point where it's warm a lot of the time, a lot more than the winter sports people want it to be. But and then what else do you do outside of work? What's fun for you?
I love to go cycling here in Singapore. So
Nice.
road cycling is—it's quite a big community, but you have to go out early to escape and beat the sun in that sense, and also a bit the traffic.
Right. So what time do you go out?
We normally go very early at 6 in the morning on a
Okay.
weekend. So it's you continue an early start to the weekend, and then you end with a coffee and a good local breakfast at 9 in the morning, and then you have had your workout when many other people are just about to start their day.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's a great way to start your day. I'm not a big morning workout person, and I had to take some time off because of some medical stuff that I had to deal with, but I do know when I make myself work out in the morning, it's fantastic and it's a great way to start the day. Well, listen, this has been really wonderful. I'd like to ask one final question of folks. When you kind of think about your life and you think about what you've done, if you went back to yourself and could talk to yourself when you got out of college, is there some piece of advice you would have given yourself based on what you know now?
Yes. So one of the things that I would have done earlier is I think I would have come to Asia before. So first time I came to Asia, I was already in my 30s. I definitely would have loved to come here early and also learn Chinese. That's one of the things I would have told myself, learn Chinese, because in this area, in this region, Chinese is driving a lot of things. Even so, the business language is English, and on the relationship side, it helps to open a lot of doors, not only in China, but in all the other regions around the world. And the other thing I would tell everyone, really also myself, just follow what you want to do. Just try out technology, and you see it with that hype of ChatGPT right now. There's always going to be something new with technology. So just the moment you're interested in, follow it and think about how you can potentially have a business or career even out of it. That is something that I would recommend to everyone. Be passionate about it, right? As long as you're passionate about what you do, you really enjoy it. And the moment I would lose my passion, I would really have to reconsider what I'm doing.
That's wonderful. And we'll put your contact information, your LinkedIn information. Do you have a simple LinkedIn handle that you can
Yes.
mention right now? What is your LinkedIn?
You will find me with Moritz B. Müller. I think you should find me in LinkedIn. That should be in there. But if you also find me as Moritz Müller as well in LinkedIn. So if you want to reach out, just discuss retrieval augmented generation, how it works in the enterprise setup. Please feel free, reach out. I really think this is a huge topic for the next
It's a huge
2 to 5 years.
Yes.
It will revolutionize the whole way we handle data.
And you know, all the consultancies and the analysts and everyone is saying that it's going to have the biggest impact of any AI initiative in large organization, any organization, retrieval augmented generation. And the market for RAG is predicted to be, it was what, $13 billion in 2023. It's predicted to be $183 billion in 2027. So yes, we're at the beginning of that hockey stick, and it is an exciting time. Well, Moritz, thank you so much for being here. It's really been a pleasure. I really appreciated your time.
Thank you, sir.
And
Same
thank
here.
you to our audience. And we will see you next time on our next podcast for the early AI podcast. Again, thanks everyone, and thank you, Moritz.
Thank you for joining us on another deep dive into AI innovation. Tune in next time when we introduce another industry expert and discuss how to maximize AI in your world. The Early AI Podcast is sponsored by Early Information Science and CMS Wire. To learn more, visit early.com. That is EARLEY.com. Thanks for tuning in.